It is now my pleasure to introduce Natalie, who's going to share her experience, strength, and hope for the next 10 minutes.
Hi, I'm Natalie. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Grateful to be here. I have to stand up? Oh, okay. Stand up. Okay. My sobriety date is June 1st, 2009, so God willing, on Monday I'll celebrate 6 years. Super excited about that. I work with a sponsor who I've been working with for the past 4 years, and I work with a sponsee who I've been working with for a couple of months now. I have 2 home groups. One is the Saturday morning LGBT People of Color meeting, and the other one is Monday night Tapestry meeting. And then I have service commitment at both of those. I'm the treasurer for the POC meeting and business meeting note taker for the TAP. So I share all of that because all of that is what helps keep me sober. The 3 requirements that my sponsor asks of me is that we meet once a week to work the steps, and we do that. That I go to 3 meetings a week at least. I'm happier on a 4 or 5 week a meeting. Meeting week, 6, 7 if I need it. And then what is the 3rd requirement? Something else, probably not to drink. And so I don't, because I love what this program has given me. I'm originally from New York. I did not get sober there, but I did have my first drink in New York. I drank for about 10 years. I was 17 when I had my first drink. I was reading a story in the Big Book last week from the back, and one of the line in the story said something about, like, only alcoholics can tell you every detail of their first drink and their last drink. And I so related to that. I was like, oh, yeah, I tell that the first drink night story all the time. Like, I just remember what that was like. I sang in a band, and we were playing a show, and I was, like, hanging out in my bandmate's car, and they were all drinking 40s, and they got me, a 4-pack of wine coolers. And so I drank the wine coolers, like, quickly and was like, what's next? Like, and that was my drinking. It took off. And my drinking looked like blackout, move, blackout, move, blackout, move. Geographics are totally part of my story. I didn't know how to deal with life or the world or people. I was so scared of people. And so I just pick up and move. I was saying to someone earlier today that I pretty much can move with my eyes closed. And I actually thought about moving today because I didn't want to come here. I thought about this last night. I was like, well, I could just move. I'll never have to see the person who asked me to come speak. It's just like, that's my default. That's where I go. And what AA has taught me is that you show up. And so today my day looked like I woke up and met with my sponsee. After meeting with my sponsee, I went to my home group, and then I went to the memorial of a friend in the program who passed away last week. And, like, what a day. Just what a day to be of service. What a day to feel, like, such community. I'm so grateful for all the people that I've met in these rooms and that, just, like, that we show up for each other and that, like, this is how we model it for each other. We do it for each other, and it was so beautiful to be at the memorial today amongst so many people in program, and we were just sitting there quietly, but you could just feel us and, like, the family. Like, we are that family. Like, I really got that today. And then we had a potluck afterwards to honor our friend, and now I'm here. And all things I wouldn't have done before, all things that I didn't do before because I was so busy running away or hiding or drinking to access anger. That was a big part of my story. I didn't know how to be angry, but I could be angry when I was drunk, and so I drank a lot to do that. I was really sad. I could do sad not drunk. I also did sad drunk, but anger was something I couldn't get to. Let's see. Pretty much everybody's story is my story. Lots of involvement with the police and car accidents and things that I would later make amends for, lies, stealing, cheating. Definitely not how I wanted to show up, but I didn't know any other way. I didn't know. I just knew that I wanted to get out of myself. I didn't want to be present, and I didn't want to remember anything. And so I drank, and luckily I was a blackout drinker, and so I never remembered. Didn't get to be present. You know, I just didn't want to be present. So I could just completely get out of myself. the fact that I'm standing here right now, like so many people say, and like not shaking to death and not crying, and maybe you can hear me, is a miracle in itself. I'm just so grateful for this program. So 10 years later, I'm in the Bay, and my last drunk looked like a regular drinking night out with a friend. We were in the city at one bar to the next, The next thing I know, I'm in a cab from the city back to the East Bay. I told the cab driver to drop me off at the bookstore. That's where I thought I lived. I do not live at the bookstore. And then I didn't have any money left in my wallet, and so I asked the cab driver to stop a couple blocks from my house and then ran to my house, not knowing that the cab was like 5 miles an hour following me to my house. And the cab driver called the police, and they tried to arrest me for public drunkenness and attempted robbery, and my partner was out there like talking to the police. And the next morning I woke up and I had like memories of my partner being upset, and she's really upset right now, and I'm trying to look for the $20 bill that I had in my dress the night before, like, where's that $20? And she's like, I have no idea what's going on with you right now. And so the memories started to come, and I just hit it. I could not do it anymore. And she had asked me to stop drinking, and I was like, I can't do this for you. It has to be for me. Like, I get that. I don't know why I got that, but I did get that it had to be for me. So I went to my therapist, finally was honest that I drank way more than I told her about, that I blacked out way more often than I told her about. And she told me about AA, and that AA gives out chips for various lengths of sobriety. And so I was like, well, I could just go to Santa Cruz and pick up some little tchotchke and carry it in my pocket, and that'll probably do the trick. And she's like, yeah, go ahead, try that. It didn't do the trick. So I went to my first meeting, and that was Tapestry, which is why I keep that as my home group. Like, so grateful that I walked in that door and that those people showed up for me and gave me numbers and gave me the big book and the 12 and 12 and called me and asked me to coffee and told me their story, and I told them mine. And just, like, again, really, this is, we show up, and we show up each other how to do it. Moved to Seattle really early on in sobriety. Didn't like the meetings there, so stopped going. But I knew that I wanted to stay sober, and I knew that the chips were some. I did get one chip before I left, and it was horrifying. It was at Tapestry, and they made me stand in front of the room, and everybody sang to us, and I was like, never again. No way am I going to tell anybody about my sobriety date, because you have to announce it to everyone and stand in front of a room full of people, and I just didn't want that. So what I did was I found some website that would mail me chips every month, and so I ordered my chips online for a year, and I listened to podcasts because I just didn't know how to go to meetings. I was so, like, judgmental. I wouldn't go to any meetings in a church. I wouldn't go to any meetings that were this. They had to be women's, like, whatever it was. I was just making excuses. I was just so scared of all of you. I'm scared of people in general. I'm scared of everyone all the time. So I did that for a year, and I was pretty lonely, sad, miserable, all that stuff. And finally, at a year, I went into a meeting. I called my first sponsor, my first temporary sponsor, and he said, just go in. And I went in and sobbed and sobbed and sobbed in the back row. And the speaker that night came up to me afterwards and was like, what did you want, a parade? And I wanted a parade. Like, nobody even knew I was doing anything because I was at home ordering my chips online. But I wanted people to, like, stand outside and cheer that I had gone 365 days and hadn't had a drop of alcohol. And so I started working the steps with her, and she was so great for me. Such a great first sponsor. She was, like, super hard ass. She made me read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Every night I had to read a different chapter and call her and tell her what I'd read. And if I'd skip a night of calling her, she'd make me start the book over, which I thought was, like, my life was coming to an end. I'm like, why do I have to start again? You know, like, I can't do this. Why are you making me do this? But she was just trying to teach me to follow rules. I didn't know how to follow rules. All I knew was how to break rules. And so I got to work with her for 2 years, only got up to the second step, and a sober brother ended up taking his life, and that really scared me from the rooms for a while. To the memorial I went to today, that's only the second person I've really gotten close to in the program who's passed, but so grateful for both of those people and that I got to know both of them. And then I moved back down here, and I've been working with a sponsor for the past 4 years, and we went through the steps the first time, and I took a year and a half on my fourth step because I like to sit in misery. I just was so afraid of the thing. I was afraid of memories that were going to come up. I was, like, making up things. I've been in my head for a real long time. I'm a future tripper and a magical thinking person. I wrote some of my fourth step, like, under the covers by the light of my cell phone. 2 minutes left. So let's see, two weeks ago, I just went home to New York and I got to make amends to my mom, dad, and brother. Didn't think that was possible, was not willing to do that the first time around. Got to make amends to a good amount of people, including writing checks for money I'd stolen out of people's bags and saying, here, this is from that night that I went into your bag and stole money from you. But my parents and my brother, I wasn't ready to make amends to. But something happened in this last 2 months that just opened a door, and I was able to do that, and I'm like, the lightness that came from me that night was super magical. I feel like I use the word magical a lot when I talk about sobriety and program, and it's probably like miraculous is what I want to be using, but I'm not there yet. It'll come. So service, super important. My higher power, I would say the best part, or, like, what works best for me around my higher power is my God box that I made at Living Sober a couple of years ago. And it's just a great practice of writing something down that I need to turn over. And, like, that works for me. Writing it down, putting it in the box, closing the box, and that's it. And sometimes it's someone's name, and sometimes it's that person's name over and over. Sometimes it's, like, trying to get pregnant. That's where I'm at right now in my life. And, like, I got to turn that over, and it'll come when it comes. Anyway, I'm really, really grateful for all that AA has given me, and thank you all so, so much.
And now Noel is going to share his drunkalog with us, with an emphasis on shooting heroin until 8:55.
I know I'm an alcoholic. Drugs are a part of my story, but I am not alone. It's interesting. I've been, my sobriety birth date is April 22nd, 2003. So it's just shy of, I just celebrated my 12 years sobriety, which is just amazing. The other day I was trying to think because, you know, I started chipping and drug use at like 10, but it was kind of 12, like when the heavy drugs started. And so I was like, I think I've been sober now longer than I've ever been in my life. And it, I was trying to wrap my brain around that, and that was kind of hard. That's my sobriety date. I have a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor for like 6 or 7 years. And I see him once a week. We have dinner and we go to a meeting. He's blind, so he has never seen me. Sometimes I can talk, and we're talking about all this program, and I can just sit quietly on my phone. And I found a sponsor that works for me. I've had a problem with sponsors. This isn't my first time around. And we'll get to that down the road. But the important thing is I've had the same person for a long time, and I've worked the steps, and I see him regularly, and that helps. It helps my sobriety. I'm a hairdresser. I do hair all day, and I talk all day, and it's easy for me. And then now I'm like, don't want to talk. But we were talking today with how it came up, but we were talking about, someone was talking about Civic Center in the city, and one of the clients was like, oh, that's kind of a little crazy down there. And then one of the coworkers was like, well, what's it like? And I'm like, well, if you take all the drug addicts from the Tenderloin and you shake them on down, like, that's what's kind of left. So if you ever want to buy dope, you got to go into the Tenderloin. Don't just stop it at Civic Center. And they all looked at me like I was crazy, but it makes sense. It totally makes sense. So I like coming to meetings because it puts me back into kind of a group that I belong to. And this is you guys are all people that I can understand, and maybe understand me, because I think, for me at least, I think my drug use is just kind of a symptom of some underlying issues. And I just, ever since I was really little, I just kind of hated everyone and I hated myself. And I just hated how I felt. And I didn't know it at the time because I think in the past 2 or 3 years, I've kind of hit like this grown-up phase of my life that I think a lot of people get maybe when they're 15 or 16. And I've just, I feel, I've picked up a lot of things. So a lot of the things I tell you about, like my early life is from the insight that I have now. But at the time, you know, I was just running around like a crazy person. I lied and I stole from as soon as I could walk. You know, my mom says that I'd look her dead in the face when I was like 4, and I'd lie and I would never tell the truth. And it was just like, how many days of the lie would I have to do? And it's just like, you know, it's like, no, I did not eat the chicken. I would do whatever the case was. I'd just lie about everything. And if I liked something, then I took it. And it wasn't like, I could be at school and they had these big red pencils and they're just thicker and bigger, and I stole like 100 of them. Because I wasn't very bright. I just, so if I saw something, I took it. If I liked something, then that's all that I'd want to do over and over again, which plays a part later in my life. But I was constantly in trouble. So it was, I don't know. I often sometimes think like, what could have been done differently to kind of stop me on this path? And I don't think anything has. And I think other people might think of addiction in one way, but I really honestly believe that there is something inside me that makes me different from the civilians that don't have a problem, who aren't sitting in these chairs. And I don't know what it is. I don't know, you know, how to fix it, but the steps, and they'll play a part too, are vital to it. So my childhood sucked, in the sense is me. I mean, it was good. I grew up in the mean streets of Danville. So I wasn't exactly suffering, but I hated it. I had problems with school. I didn't have any friends. I'd make a friend and then I'd come over to the house and play. And then I'd like their little Star Wars figures. And so I stole fucking every one of them. And I came home and it was just a thing. I just, even before drugs, I destroyed every little relationship that I made. And I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was fear. I just think that I, am really uncomfortable and I, do not like being uncomfortable, and I would do whatever it took for me to shift that out. I was horribly self-obsessed, you know, and it just all sets the stage. So, my mom was a nurse. My dad, did computer stuff. I lived in a middle-class neighborhood. Home life wasn't great, but it, you know, all that's kind of like icing on the cake. I was already kind of on this trajectory. I'd be bored at home and my parents wouldn't be around, and I would go up into their medicine cabinet and I'd start on the left. And I would just eat everything. And I'd just do it row at a time. And this happened all the time. My mom finally got fed up because she kept having to take me to the emergency room to get my stomach pumped or charcoal or something like that. She'd come home and, you know, I'd be like 8 and I'd be like passed out in a pool of vomit, like in the floor. And it was just a lot. So she kept a bottle of charcoal and Ipecac at home so that we could just pump my own stomach. And that was that, you know, I love my mom, but that's her solution, you know, which I easily, you know, it sucked because I never wanted to go to school. So I would be like, oh, I don't want to go to school. I'm sick. And she's like, I'm a fucking nurse. You're fine. Go to, you know, and she knew all the tricks until the Ipecac. So I would wake up early while she was in the shower. I would belly crawl into the bathroom. I'd take the Ipecac. I'd drink a couple slugs of it. I'd put it back. I'd go back in my room and just pretend I was asleep. And then she'd come in and wake me up, and I'd be like, oh, I don't feel very well. And she's like, no, you're not barfing. You don't have a fever. You're going to school. And I get to halfway through breakfast, and I just vomit everywhere. And she's like, oh, my God, you are sick, you know? Holy shit. So I get all this attention. I get cookies. I get my, you know, and I'd be up. And then she'd go off to work. And then as soon as she's gone, I'd start in on the medicine cabinet. I sniffed glue. I sniffed gas. I discovered my dick, and I masturbated all the time. My mom, in the car once, my mom was just like, oh, my God, you cannot do that. So that was kind of growing up. Like, you know, my amends, my mom was all over that. My mom tried really, really hard, and I probably could have been medicated. They could have talked to me about drugs, and they could have done all these things, and they didn't. And I don't know. I think, you know, for some of us, maybe for some people, their drug use can be arrested at some point, and they can kind of learn. Maybe they have to learn. They learn from their mistakes, and they move on. And I was not that person. I drank at 10. I had no idea what I was doing. I was 10 years old. It was New Year's Eve. I went to the liquor cabinet. I grabbed wild turkey because I had a picture of a turkey and I liked animals. I drank 2 shots. I vomited a couple times, and that was it. I had nothing until the next morning, and I was still puking the next morning. I think my dad knew. My dad was a big drinker, and, you know, there's only so much guile a 10-year-old or 12-year-old can have around alcohol in the house without somebody being like, you know, oh, you smell like alcohol, or, you know, whatever the case is. But no one ever really did anything. It was such a horrible experience, though, that I didn't drink for 2 years. That's where gas and sniffing gas and glue and everything else came into being. One of my brother's friends turned me on to crosstops, which I guess was... and I liked those. And I was already bouncing off the walls, so it was interesting. But then someone turned me on to vitamin C too, and I ate I'd eat bottles of that, and I would be like, I'd trade Jolly Ranchers for them. I was totally determined that they were like that they were gonna get me loaded. let's see how it is. But yeah, it was, I think that my inability to be comfortable with myself, that when I first discovered drugs or alcohol, it wasn't so much, I think a few things happened. I think it was really fun in the beginning, and that fun was way up here, and my mundane life was way down here, and to me it was never... It was a very easy decision, and it also it made me feel better, and I'm already predisposed that if something makes me feel better, I want to do it all the time. And to me, that doesn't there's nothing bad about that phrase. Like, I really want to feel great all the time, and if I can feel great all the time, then I really want to feel infinitely better all the time. And if that led to a lot of overdoses, that led to a lot of trips to the ER and a lot of hospitalizations. I was just always kind of pushing the edge with my drinking and my drug use, and I never knew when to stop. And I think how I learned to stop is like when I got arrested, when I shit the bed and had to go off into paramedics. Mass horrible events had to happen for me to be like, oh. Okay, Everclear is bad. Everclear and a 22 is bad. So I can go from now on, and I'm not going to combine those two things again. And I just had to learn shit the hard way all the time. I think my first exposure to AA was when I was a teenager. I was court-ordered. I spent a lot of time in juvenile hall in my teenage years. There were times when I was really young where I knew I was too young to be put in jail because they're like, oh, you've caught you stealing. We're going to put you in jail for the weekend. And I knew that, like, I'm 11. You are not going to put me in jail, right? But I was constantly in trouble. And I don't think I had to learn the lessons the hard way, too. So, I mean, I was a wee lad in Danville, and I had a horrible record. I was just constantly getting in trouble. It was vandalism. It was, I don't even know. I mean, I was stupid shit. I asked my mom once, because I spent about a year, a little over a year in juvenile hall. And from there, I went to a therapeutic group home. And from there, I went to rehab. And I was trying to figure out what I was arrested for. Because I was like, the last thing I remember is I popped this little girl's balloon. I was drunk, and I popped this girl's balloon at like pizza. It was like a pizza place or something. And I thought that was the funniest thing in the world. And cops came and arrested me. And they're like, yeah. And I was like, but what did, you know, that's it's awfully a long time to be. And my mom was like, you know, they... And she was funny because she's like, you know, they kind of tricked me. They're like, you know, you're getting in so much trouble. I was homeless in Danville and living on the mean streets. And they said that they could help me, but they needed my mom to, like, sign me over to the courts, right? And so at, like, 16, she signed me away to courts. And I sat in juvenile hall for a long time in therapy, group home, and rehab because I wasn't getting it. So it's interesting. I think my mom was fed up because I don't think she really knew so much how to handle me. But my first exposure with AA was as a teenager out in Dublin. I went to a meeting. I don't remember why I was there or what happened. I just I remember that there's a part that says, you know, if you've used today, you know, stay and talk to someone out of the meeting, which is really inviting. It's like, look, if you've gotten loaded today and you need to talk to someone, we're here. And what I heard was, like, if you've used today, we don't want to hear you speak at all. And we just kind of want you to just shut the fuck up and maybe go away. And so I was like, that's what I did. I didn't say a word. I glared at everybody and I left. And I was like, that was my experience with AA. I lived in Chico for a little bit too, because I moved around a lot. I would completely destroy my local environment to the point where everyone was fed up with my shit, and then I would get shipped off to someplace, and I would just repeatedly do the thing. So at one point, I was living in a trailer in my girlfriend's house in Danville, out in her front yard, and then that was my... It was just a mess. It was a mess. I was at such a low part in my life, and every day was just, I was drinking, I was doing a lot of drugs, I wasn't taking care of myself, I wasn't really functioning at all. And if I was smarter, then maybe I would have, like, killed myself. But it was that I was so depressed and so miserable, and I didn't even acknowledge my own depression until I was, like 16 or 17 in a hospital, and I heard people talk about how horrible life was, and then I was able to connect what they were saying to things that I've felt since I was like 12, and I'm like, oh, I've been very depressed and suicidal since I was 12. But I was in Chico, and a friend of mine had like 30 DUIs. I don't even know how many. He had this like badass Camaro, and he just was a horrible drunk. He'd come over, he'd pass out on your couch, he'd pee all over it, and that was just like, and just get DUIs. And he has court ordered to DUI, so I got to drive his car, and we could have been like, I would have driven that car anywhere, but he's like, we have to go to AA meetings, and so I went. And none of it applied to me at all. Like, it never, I was only there because I got to drive this car. I was in Chico, I was, too young to be in Chico, and all the college girls, like, nobody was, like, none of the college girls were paying any attention to me, and so the only thing I got to do was drive this car, and we'd go to meetings a lot, and it never even dawned on me that I was part of this. So I joined the Army, because that's what one does when my local environment was destroyed. Here's a good example. My brother was gone. I was living with my brother because that's how I rolled. So he was gone for a couple weeks in the Marine Corps, and I was in charge. That was also in the Everclear, and the 22 came into play. But prior to that, I had a little dog, and I really liked my little dog. And I was also found a speed connection up there. And so I put the dog in the bathroom because I was like, it's a small dog. I don't want it to destroy everything. And I'm just going to go get loaded because I have a couple weeks, and it's going to be fine. And I left, and I came back like 2 weeks later. And the dog wasn't alive anymore. The house, the bathroom was just a big, it was just a huge fucking mess. And so that's, I solved that problem by Everclear in a 22, and I still have a scar from the 22. But that was, so I destroyed that. I went off, I joined the Army. This time I had to come back to, I had like 3 months before I shipped out for the Army. And so I went back to Danville and I tried staying with my dad, who I've had a horrible relationship all of my life. And that didn't work. So I wound up back out on the streets in Danville. And then I went to Concord and I lived in this tiny little apartment and just spent my days drinking and wishing I were dead. I went to the Army, and that was really cool. Until I discovered speed again, and you know, it's there's a theme. I can start from nothing, and I can get some traction. I can build a little life for myself. I get a place to stay. I can get some clothes. I can get a pet. I could do all these little things, and then it all goes. I lose it all. And it's part of, I still haven't quite figured out 12 steps yet. It's so unfathomable for me to think that I was the problem. To me, the drinking and the drug use, they weren't even part of the solution. I wasn't even advanced that far. This is what I did. The first time I injected speed, I was 13, and as soon as I could think again, I made a pact with myself that this is what I wanted to feel all the time, and everything else was irrelevant. And I guess part of my depression and part of like my self-loathing and stuff is just my inability to handle feeling uncomfortable, and it had probably a lot to do with this is not a victim. I used to think it was a victim, so I'm like, who am I really hurting? And I'm hurting every single person that comes in contact with me over and over again. And the fact that I could start, and that the fact that I could be good for a little bit, and then everything goes straight to shit, I think just made it worse. And this was constant my entire life. I would start something, I would get a job, I would get a couple bucks, and then I would start drinking, or I'd think it'd be a good idea. And once I start drinking, I have no idea what's going to happen next. Surprise! It took me. I remember. So I was full fast forward a bunch. I was 18. I was in jail, and I thought that this was my first felony case as an adult. And I thought that I'd already been thrown out of the Army. I thought that I was just going to get a slap on the wrist, and we went to court. I was all smirking, and then the district attorney or whoever was like, okay, my lawyer, my whatever, my free lawyer was like, you know, they're willing to cut you a deal. And I was like, great, I'm going to walk out of here. I'm going to be loaded by tonight, and everything's going to be great. And they're like, attempted murder, 3 years in the pen. And I was flabbergasted. And it sorted itself out. I spent a year in San Francisco in county jail. I did 6.5 months. It came up early that maybe we could do a drug diversion. And I had a tiny moment of clarity where I was like, no, I need to. If I did a drug diversion now, it was because I didn't want to go to jail. And so I just did my time. And then towards the end of my sentence, I began to think that maybe maybe my drug use was the problem. Maybe I was the problem. Because I had a plan. I had a fantastic plan getting out of jail. I was going to just fuck off on my probation. I was going to rob tiny little mom-and-pop stores, you know, like a shoe shop or a hair salon. And I was going to use that to finance my drug use, and I was just going to go up to Canada. That was my goal. And then I think we were like pretty close to getting out when I started thinking that perhaps that was this stupid plan. And I wasn't quite ready to look, like, it's weird. It's like, yeah, there's the door, right? And you finally acknowledge that there's this door. I'm not quite ready to open it up. I'm not quite ready to like, look inside. But it's like, I've acknowledged that there's a door. So I went off to rehab. I went to East Palo Alto, a place. Ultimately, there is, nothing simple with me. But eventually, it was Daytop Village in East Palo Alto, and for a while I was the only white boy there, and it was fantastic. They taught me to play basketball. I was picked last. It was great. Behavior modification. I've always been in rehabs. I've always been yelled at. I spent almost 2 years there, and this was like old school where you did shit, and then you dug a fucking hole, and you put a fork in it, and you filled the hole back up. So which way the fork was sticking, and you're like, oh, what the fuck did I know? And you spend a week digging a hole because you're in, you know, they had funny little things like, you know, I was caught running in the hallway, so I had to, you know, walk 5 steps forward and 2 steps back, you know, for like 2 weeks. It was deep behavior modification. I think what they were trying to do at the time, which was to show you that what you're doing, the big picture of things, you know, and have you look. And I left there sober for 2 years because I was living in a facility. And I was already overanalyzing my behavior constantly. And it took like, it was like a month and a half before I started drinking again. Because drugs were my problems. Drinking, I was fine. And twice in 24 hours, I was in the emergency room. And it never dawned on me that I needed to stop. That led more to more drug use, which led to more broken hearts, more destroyed lives, more homelessness, more arrests. And I think I don't think I really got it until like 2000 and 2001. I started seeing again, and I don't know what difference this was than the countless other times, but I'd lost everything again. I was by myself. I was back at my mom's house because my mom is the only person that could put up with my shit. And there's hospitalizations. I was medicated. I was like, I need rehab and I need something that's going to work. I started applying myself. Still, AA was absent. This is still like, none of these rehabs were really AA, and nothing ever stuck. I remember walking down 7th Street to an intake at a 90-day program there. I had hepatitis C. I was hella sick. I was dope sick. I was vomiting all the way down there. I was vomiting in her trash can while I was doing the intake interview. And she was trying to tell me that they couldn't have a bed for me for a few more weeks. And then she's like, look, just come in tomorrow. And that saved my life. I threw myself into the program. I stopped trying to do things my way. We had meetings there, and I read the steps. I read the book. I try to just absorb it. There is something that I needed to do. It's like, if AA was a pill or a drug, like, how could I take it to give me that feeling that everyone else had that I missed? And that wasn't my last time sober, but I had a few more little relapses as I was ironing out the wrinkles before it finally stuck. I came into AA. I did whatever was necessary. I had sponsors. Many, many, many sponsors. I'd get to the fourth step, the fifth step, and then I'd just cut them loose and find somebody else. I didn't like people when I was sober and when I was little. I didn't like people when I was using, and I still don't like people so much. You know, but I kept at it. Everyone was like, you know, every time I did something and I got loaded, I was like, okay, what I'm doing isn't right. I need to change it. And so people were like, you need to come to meetings every day. And so I did that, and that didn't work. You need to get a sponsor. I did that. That's not working. They're like, you need a higher power. And that didn't work. And like, you need a higher power that's big enough to stand between you and your first drink. And I could not wrap my mind around that, because if I could conjure one up, I would. I was just so desperate to stay sober. And on top of that, I was miserable. When I am sober, I am very sad. I am very depressed. My first 5 years of sobriety were horrible for me. And everyone always said that if I stopped getting loaded, I stopped drinking, then I would be happy. And I was waiting, and I was waiting, and I was waiting. And I didn't understand what I was doing wrong, because I was going to meetings, or sometimes I was going to like 2 meetings a day. I had sponsors. I read the big book. I accosted these poor Mormons on the street and became a Mormon because they didn't drink. That was awesome. So yeah, I tried religion. I tried everything, and it just wasn't alleviating. I wasn't using, right, which was the point, but I wasn't feeling any better. And the doctors were just like, yeah, you need to spend some more time sober before your body adjusts. 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 years, and they're like, yeah, you're fucked. This is as good as it's going to get for you. And I had to make a conscious decision. Like, does this suck? And it's like, yes. Luckily, I had really good doctors, and I was heavily medicated, but nobody was giving me anything good, right? And it's always been my case. Doctors take one look at me, and they're like, uh-uh. No. Which I think has saved me a lot, because I never got into the pills, because I went to heroin. So it was interesting. I had to make the decision that is this better than me using, and it was. And I wasn't happy with it. I wasn't, you know, my spirituality and these steps didn't come to. It wasn't a burning bush. I went kicking and screaming. I waited and waited and waited, and I just kind of. I just kind of sulked and felt miserable. And for some grace of God, I didn't get loaded. I remember someone a long time ago, it was in Pleasanton, and they're like, we're going to go to a pancake breakfast after this. And I was like, that's like, I mean, on one hand, it's like so beautiful, and it almost makes me cry. And the second thing is, it's just so fucking stupid. And they're like, why don't you come with us? You know? And I was like, no, I don't have any money. I don't have anything to offer. And they're like, well, we're not going to eat. You can just come and you just sit there. And I was like, fine. And I came and sit there, and they bought me pancakes, which was, you know, that was probably one of the nicest things anyone had done to me for a long time. Which shows you how low my bar was. You know, but he said something, because I was just like, you know, what am I supposed to do? And I just don't get it. I want, like, this, it's just, I can't wrap my brain around it, right? And he's like, you know what? Don't drink. Go to meetings. And just don't drink in between. And I was, the first time I've ever heard, this is never an option to me. I never even knew that that existed, that I could go to a meeting every day, and if I didn't drink in between them, then I was doing this program. And that's kind of been my motto the entire time. I didn't do this very well in the beginning, and I still probably don't do it very well today. But the part that I do really well is I go to fucking meetings and I don't drink in between, no matter what. I've had really good things happen to me in sobriety that I haven't screwed up. I've had some horrible things happen to me in sobriety, and I didn't stood up. I got divorced a couple years ago, and I lived on my own for the first time ever. And I've grown up a lot, I think, in these past few years. And I think when I moved in by myself, I was terrified because for the first time in my sober life, I was rolling solo. It was me and Dog. And I am, you know, the destroyer of all things. Like, there's so much fear about that. And I went to meetings. I did 90 and 90. I talked. I participated. I tried to wiggle myself through the to the middle of the herd because I know that when left to my own devices, I destroy things. And slowly over the months, I realized that that I was fine. And so I'll be 45 this year. So roughly at 43, I've come to the conclusion that I am going to be okay. And I swear that everybody else gets that shit at like 8. And the reason I think it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I have a car. It doesn't matter if I have a job. If I'm dating someone or not. Or I could lose a limb. I could be homeless, and it doesn't matter. It's gonna suck. But I'm underneath all the bullshit. Like I'm gonna be okay, and I'm gonna be okay because I come to meetings and I don't drink in between. And it's interesting. I have friends who have had problems. This is, like I said, it's not a victimless, this isn't a victimless thing. Like everyone, that touches people, gets affected by this. And I know that like once I start drinking, I have no idea where it's going to go. It's going to go down, but I have no idea like who I'm going to take with me or what. It's, that's like the powerlessness, right? But prior to that first drink, I have like all the power. It doesn't matter how bad I want something or how much my mom didn't love me or how much I really want to be liked. Prior to me taking that first drink, at some point, I make a conscious decision to get loaded, and I do. And so I know that if left to my own devices, if I feel miserable long enough, then that first drink is going to make a lot more sense than it makes now. Now it's far from my mind. But when shit gets tough, or someone takes my parking spot, or someone's driving too slow, like that starts looking like a good idea. And if I'm broke, I have no money, and I'm hungry, and I'm like, oh, I'll just steal some money from the register at work. It's only $5. Like that type of shit can cost me a job. It costs me a job, then I can be homeless. And if I'm homeless and living under the bridge, then perhaps I'm going to think that, hey, having a drink is going to be a good idea. So how I do this is I have daily adult supervision. I talk to people. I have lots of friends. Oh, not lots of friends. I have at least 7 friends. So I can call each one once a day. I go to meetings. Sometimes it's once a week. Sometimes it's 3 times a week. Sometimes it's 7 times a week, but every single day of the week, I have a meeting that if push comes to shove that I can go. I see a sponsor. I bounce shit off of people before I just act. And all of these are good ideas because I don't have the best ideas still. I still have to watch out for what I do because I still, if something feels, if I have a good day with my pal, right, and I come home and I'm like, I've had a really good day with my pal, then the first thing I want to do the next day is have that exact same day with my pal. We're going to do the exact same things. We're going to generate the exact same fucking feeling, right? And it doesn't work that way. And then I get pissed off. And then I'm like, well, maybe I'll try harder. So I go to meetings, I talk about things, and I don't drink in between. And all of these steps, I think, come sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I didn't see God, but I've had a fundamental change in myself to where I know without a doubt that drugs and alcohol are the problem. It's a problem. It's not the solution. I have other problems of my own that I at once went to drugs because I thought that solved that, but it doesn't, it's not how it works. So now I come to meetings, and that's my solution. So thanks.